the threat of climate change is already taking a toll on American cities.
I can't even really describe it other than to say disgusted and really angry and really defeated.
I'm Carol Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, persistent flooding in the basement of a Chicago neighborhood inspires a woman to action. And as a former astronaut, this man saw Earth from a perspective most of us will never experience. And here's how he views climate change.
Am I optimistic that the human race can fight its way out of this particular situation? I am.
Plus, the way one Pittsburgher spends his time along the Allegheny River raises some eyebrows.
They think I'm an absolute nut.
Those environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. You've probably heard the saying, no one on their deathbed ever says, I wish I would have spent more time at the office. It's generally assumed that when we get toward the end of life, we'll want to focus on our loved ones. And the last thing we'll be thinking about is work. But this is a story about a man recently diagnosed with terminal cancer. Now, all he wants to do is talk about his work. He's a former astronaut who says the job he has to do now as a climate scientist is just too important to leave undone. As part of WBEZ Chicago's Heat of the Moment, which explores stories about everyday life on a changing planet, Alex Kodlowitz reports.
Let me be upfront. I first met Pierre Sellers because he's dying. I spent some time with Sellers this spring. He looked thinner than his photos from his days as an astronaut. At 61, he's a swoon-worthy, handsome man, but his white dress shirt draped loosely on his shoulders, as if it was a size too big. He told me he'd lost 30 pounds in 3 weeks, a result of the drugs he's taking. Honestly, I don't think that Sellers would like me mentioning this all here, at the beginning of his story. He doesn't like talking about his health.
Yeah, I'm still alive, man, and I'm always optimistic.
I'll return to this, his optimism, in a bit. But let me begin by telling you his story. That way I think you'll understand why I'm here with Sellers in the first place. As a young boy growing up in England, Sellers yearned to go into space, and so in 1991, at the age of 36, he became a U.S. citizen. At the time, he was a climate scientist working at NASA's Earth Science Center, a place called Goddard. 5 years later, he left his job as a climate scientist when he got selected to become an astronaut.
Atlantis, roger.
His first flight was aboard the space shuttle Atlantis.
The throttle up call from Capcom Ken Ham, joined on the flight deck by mission specialist Pierce Sellers, seated down on the mid-deck.
I didn't have a religious epiphany or anything like that at all. It did change my perceptions a bit.
Like you're probably picking up, Sellers is no nonsense, a scientist who's grounded in what he knows to be true. But he also told me that on that first flight, right after the launch, he looked out the window. What he saw left him in awe. The equivalent, I suppose, of a scientific epiphany.
You get up there, and the Earth is this huge ball, and there's like this tiny film of gas around it. When you look at the horizon, it's just a thin, thin blue ribbon, you know, which is the atmosphere. I mean, there's almost nothing there.
It's so thin, like an onion skin, he thought.
So, wow, is that all we have? Gosh. But that really brought home to me that this whole business of humans, through fairly modest actions, being able to have a huge impact on the atmosphere, because there isn't much of it.
This flight in 2002 was a time when top government officials denied the existence of global warming. And so what Sellers saw had a big impact on him, driving home what he already knew from years immersed in the data, that the Earth was more vulnerable than most thought. In the end, he flew a total of 3 missions and took 6 spacewalks before he wrapped up his time as an astronaut. Done with space in 2011, he had to decide what to do next. He made what to some seemed like an unusual choice.
And we were surprised he came back.
This is Paul Newman, not the Paul Newman. This is one of Sellers' co-workers at Goddard.
You know, he could have had a pick of a lot of the jobs in NASA. But he chose to come here.
Here is NASA's Earth Sciences Division at the Goddard Space Flight Center just outside of Washington, D.C. When Sellers quit being an astronaut, as Newman said, he really could have gone just about anywhere. But he chose to become a bureaucrat, but an important one, a leader of the government's efforts to study climate change. As director of Earth Sciences at Goddard, he oversees 1,500 scientists and engineers who, using data from satellites and from ground research stations, work to more precisely measure where the carbon comes from and where it's going, and to predict what lies ahead. Their climate models have become so important that public officials regularly visit for briefings. Sellers' new job is one that's gotten him into some public scrapes. 2 years ago, Steve Stockman, a congressman from Texas, visited, and Sellers tried to do what he always does, which is lay out the science and break things down in layman's terms. But not long after, at a congressional hearing, Representative Stockman took a shot at Sellers, really kind of mocking him.
I mean, some of the things that they're talking about mathematically and scientifically don't make sense. He said that what ended the Ice Age was global wobbling. That's what I was told. This is a lead scientist down in Maryland. You're welcome to go down there and ask him the same thing.
Sellers felt insulted.
I felt that what we said was being distorted. I don't think we have to stand for that. I'm a civil servant, right? That doesn't mean to say that I'm deaf and dumb.
So Sellers fired back in an equally public way. In a New York Times op-ed, he scolded the congressman for what he said was trivializing the accepted theories. Congress funds Goddard, and so Sellers took some heat inside NASA for skirmishing with the congressman. But he takes such pride in that moment that the piece, 2 years later, is still tacked to his bulletin board.
Now, wobbling on climate change was the first op-ed I did in 2014. That's the Times, yeah. So you can borrow it if you want.
I recently visited Sellers at his office, building number 33 on Goddard's 1,200-acre complex. Despite his weight loss, he still looks remarkably fit. He has an open face and a mischievous smile. I was at Goddard to see him because he had publicly disclosed this past January in a second New York Times op-ed that he had been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. After months of fatigue and various aches, he'd gone to a doctor and was told that barring some small miracle, he had a year and a half or 500 days to live.
You know, I told my close friends and family fairly quickly after diagnosis and then sent out a circular to everybody, which says, hey, I've been diagnosed with cancer, and all this stuff. And I said, reasons to be cheerful. This has greatly simplified my retirement planning, gets me out of jury duty, and there is a promise of improved parking access in D.C., which is like gold. So, you know.
This is Sellers, jocular and playful. But around the time of his diagnosis, he made a weighty decision. This is what he wrote about in the New York Times, and it's what I wanted to talk to him about. He wrote about how he wanted to spend the rest of his life. He said he wanted to spend time with his two grown children, but that he had no interest in hanging out on a beach or climbing some mountain. He wrote,
"As for me, I have no complaints. I'm very grateful for the experiences I've had on this planet. As an astronaut, I spacewalk 220 miles above the Earth. Floating alongside..."
He wrote about the need for policymakers to catch up with the science, and he concluded this way.
"From this God's eye view, I saw how fragile and infinitely precious the Earth is. I'm hopeful for its future. And so, I'm going to work tomorrow."
It feels so plain, but he's saying, "I have very few days left in the world, and I know how I want to use them. Continue to lead and shape NASA's climate work, and speak to as many people as I can about what I know and about what I've seen." It's like he's launched into a sprint.
"I don't have time to stalk this horse slowly over many years. I thought I better, get what's been on my mind for a while out there quickly and as clearly as I can."
He's adamant that little has changed in the way he conducts himself, but it's clear that because of his failing health, more people are listening.
Pierre Sellers, welcome to GPS.
Great to be here, Fareed.
This is him on CNN speaking with Fareed Zakaria.
I mean, I think every one of us wonders, what would I do in a situation like that? All these emotions swirling in your head.
Actually, the emotion swirling in the head part took about 10 minutes, to be honest.
I learned quickly that while he's happy to get the attention, to get his message and ideas out, he has no patience with people who want to dwell on the personal drama of his health. Trust me, I tried going there.
So here's something asking me. So you talk about optimism, but it's got to, in some ways, be hard given your own situation.
No.
Am I optimistic that the human race can fight its way out of this particular situation? I am. I mean, we've done it before so many times. When we're in a fix, we found some way out of it.
It's simple for him. He's been to space, he knows what humans are capable of, and is convinced that with the same kind of single-mindedness and inventiveness we can find a way to slow down the warming of the globe. I've got to admit, sometimes his optimism feels more like wishful thinking. In his op-ed, he declared last year was the death of denial. I pointed out to him that one presidential candidate has called climate change a hoax, and the conservative Breitbart news site responded to his op-ed with an article sarcastically headlined, "NASA Chief, Global Warming is Real Because I Have Cancer."
Push the sled along. Yep. Does he work with a polar bear?
This past spring, in between chemotherapy treatments, Sellers chose to visit Greenland. Just the kind of thing you'd find on a climate scientist's bucket list.
Greenland and the ice sheets of Greenland are really the canary in the coal mine for global climate change.
He'd never been there before, and he wanted to see it firsthand. The only place with more ice is Antarctica, and Greenland is warming more than twice as fast as the rest of the world.
You guys look like you're ready for the tropics.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to hitch a ride with the Royal Danish Air Force on a C-130 across Greenland. And after we got going, I was invited up into the cockpit. Terrific view.
When he talks about this flight, it's like that first time in space, when he saw the thinness of the atmosphere. Something he knew intellectually became visceral.
And as the clouds cleared, we came out of a clear patch, and I could see this huge ice massif, and then these immense rivers of ice, these glaciers slowly flowing out from them. I understood the numbers, I've seen the satellite data, I've seen the graphs, but when you actually see the glaciers themselves and how massive they are and the volume of discharge, clearly Greenland is losing ice at a massive rate. It really grounds you in reality as to what's going on.
There's an irony, I suppose, in Sellers' situation. He announces he's dying, but he doesn't want to talk about himself. He's used his illness to get people's attention, so that he can talk about what he's seen from space or from flying over Greenland, so that he can underscore the urgency around global warming. It's that important to him. I came away thinking it's kind of remarkable to see someone who can't forestall his own mortality working so hard to forestall the mortality of the planet. When Sellers returned from Greenland, he missed a day of work for a medical procedure, and we had to move our interview back a day. When we spoke, I asked how his health was. "Bumpy," he replied, and then he moved on. It's tough, too, on those around him. When I walked the halls of Goddard, colleagues, when they heard I was working on a story about Sellers, would choke up. One of them described him as larger than life, another as transformational. They seemed galvanized by his resolve. But honestly, most of them seem just happy that they have him around for a while. This is Alex Kotlowitz, WBEZ.
We're hoping you'll add your voice to the conversation about the changing world around us. I See Change is the climate and weather app that you can use to record your observations and questions about what you see going on outdoors. iPhone users can download the I See Change app and start reporting on the current heat wave that's left many of us sweating buckets and hiding in our air conditioning. You can even post your own dog days of summer photos. With that data, the Allegheny Front is partnering with I See Change to help tell the larger story of climate in our region. So get the I See Change app, that's I-S-E-E Change, or go to iseechange.org and join us. Climate change isn't going to affect everyone the same way. There are islands that will disappear. Parts of the world will spend years in drought. Wealthier nations might be able to prepare, while poorer ones might get hit hardest. You don't have to travel halfway around the world to see this disparity. Sometimes you just have to take a bus ride across town. Reporter Shannon Heffernan did this in Chicago for WBEZ's Heat of the Moment series. Here's her story.
Cheryl Watson still lives in the home where she grew up, and she doesn't want to leave. It's in the Chatham neighborhood, a place known as the Jewel of the South Side. And even when Cheryl was a little girl back in the 1950s, something about this place felt special to her. It was full of black-owned businesses and perfectly manicured lawns.
And everyone knew each other for miles around because the churches were teeming with residents. All the kids played in the park together. So there was that greater family feeling.
But in a segregated city like Chicago, Chatham had to fight hard to get what it needed. Neighbors lobbied the city for better schools and fixed up streets. Even buying a house here was a fight. It was so difficult to get a loan as a black man that Cheryl's dad had to have a white guy sign all the mortgage papers. Perhaps because everything was so hard won, people took a lot of pride in their homes, and still do. Before Cheryl's dad passed away, he asked her to keep the house in the family.
And so this is something I would really, really, really like to hold on to for the rest of my life.
But holding on to her home may not be easy. The Chatham neighborhood is, in a way, in the middle of a climate change disaster. It's not the kind of disaster you normally think of. There's no huge single event with TV cameras and Red Cross campaigns. It's something less visible, more everyday. To understand the rest of the story, we have to talk here about urban flooding. Over the years, cities everywhere have added more pavement, parking lots, streets. That means when it rains, there's less dirt to absorb it. The water doesn't have anywhere to go, so it seeps into people's foundations. Climate change research tells us that heavy rain is becoming more common in Chicago. But Cheryl already knew that. You can actually see how the watermarks in her basement have gotten higher over time.
And no one really can tell you how this can be resolved.
The city gets more calls about flooding in Chatham and its surrounding areas than anywhere else in the entire city. But Cheryl still felt like she was alone. After all, this was a disaster that was happening inside houses, away from public view. She tried to talk to her neighbors about it. She brought a bunch of pamphlets and information to a block club meeting. But she says everyone just had this deer in the headlights look on their face.
It was kind of that look like, oh, she knows our secret.
Cheryl says people were scared that if word got out about flooding, their home value would drop. Plus, it can be really embarrassing. All that rainwater also gets into the sewage system, gets mixed up with all that nasty stuff. During a heavy rain, the sewage system can get overwhelmed. And then sewage backs up into people's homes. Lori Burns lives about 5 blocks away from Cheryl. She's a little bit younger, and she inherited her home from her grandparents. In 2008, there were 2 back-to-back storms. Lori remembers seeing it pouring down and thinking she better get home. When she did, she found her house was filling with sewage.
And it's all coming up through the toilet, through the drains in the floor in the laundry room, and wherever else.
The smell was awful. Her college papers, childhood keepsakes, they were all soaked in sewage water. Lori has a calm, matter-of-fact demeanor. She's a problem solver and went right into action, called up her brother. It wasn't the first time it had happened, so they knew what to do. Together, they spent days scrubbing the whole place with bleach and throwing stuff out.
I can't even really describe it other than to say disgusted and really angry and really defeated.
She remembers going to a nearby Target and seeing all these people stocking up on mops and plastic gloves. People in the neighborhood bought hip waders, not to fish, but to go into their own homes. Lori remembers being in the checkout line and realizing, oh, it's not just her. This is a thing in Chatham.
And it's like, wow, this is the future? That we're having these storms where there's more than 2 inches of rain or 3 inches that fall within an hour or something like that?
This is what climate change will look like for most of us. It will be the mundane things, the stuff you have to call the city about. It won't be sudden or flashy, not tsunamis or tidal waves, but creep up, like water from a basement. Over the next few years, Lori started looking around for solutions. One night, she landed on this website for floodproofing her home.
And there was this thing, the flyer for the Gross Gathering.
It was literally called the Gross Gathering.
Because it's gross to have raw sewage in your basement. Hello. So I'm like, okay, well, I don't care where this is, I'm going.
The meeting was on the north side, run by this group called Center for Neighborhood Technology. There weren't many African-American people at the meeting. People were from Northside areas, places like Albany Park. Lori noticed that, took note that she was probably the only person there from her neighborhood, even though it's in one of the most regularly flooded areas in Chicago.
I determined then whatever they were getting, we were going to get. And soon after that, I saw online, like on a Sunday night, and I just came across this thing. And it was a press release saying that Albany Park area, hard hit by flooding, and there's like many, many millions of dollars that the city came up with in order to make sure that something big, some big project can start happening there to make sure that they don't ever suffer from this kind of flooding again. I was pissed.
Lori thought the Albany Park neighborhood deserved all the help it could get. She was just mad that Chatham wasn't getting the same kind of attention from the city. A spokesperson from the city of Chicago says it has updated pipes and infrastructure in Chatham. And comparing Albany Park and Chatham is unfair. Albany Park is near a river, so a different problem than Chatham, which is in a really low-lying part of Chicago. But still, in the same way that most climate change problems will be everyday and mundane, the struggle to find solutions will be that way too. It won't be all about calling in the National Guard. It will be about city services, aldermen, sewers. And the same problems we complain about with city services, those are the things Lori and her neighbors believe they will be up against when it comes to climate change fixes.
And there is this notion or assumption, whatever you want to call it, that these sides of the city don't get the same services or the same attention that, say, the north side or the northwest sides of the city do.
And so Lori took things into her own hands. She reached out to the Center for Neighborhood Technology, that organization that held the meeting on the north side. And together they started working on flooding problems in Chatham. They gathered data and realized that Chatham had more insurance claims for flooding than anywhere else in the city. That sounds like bad news, but it was also kind of comforting for Lori, because it was like this thing she thought was happening, now she had tangible proof.
Because we weren't really understanding how endemic the problem was or how expansive it was, there wasn't this groundswell of activity to say, hey, this is a huge disease that we have that's ruining our homes, diminishing home values, and really demoralizing as a homeowner.
Armed with this information, Lori and CNT have started organizing neighbors, people like Cheryl, the woman we heard at the top of this story. CNT also helped Lori get a special thing called a backup valve installed. They can be really expensive, and a lot of people can't afford them. Lori says it's worked really well. But the sewage she's keeping out of her home, it didn't disappear. It's just flowing down the line to her neighbor's homes.
Fine, you protect your home, but you're screwing your neighbor. So it doesn't solve the problem, it just solves the problem for me.
Of course, there's an obvious way people could handle this. They could just move, change neighborhoods. But not everyone has the cash to do that, and it's hard to sell a house with flooding problems. And besides, a lot of people are like Lori. They don't like passing a problem down the line. They want it actually solved. And so, as spring arrives with all its storms, Lori will be out there knocking on doors and calling the city. She knows she can't change the weather, but she can make sure Chatham is ready for it. Shannon Heffernan, WBEZ.
You can't see or smell radon, but it's the second leading cause of lung cancer after smoking. Pennsylvania has some of the highest radon levels in the country, and a study published late last year said fracking in the Marcellus Shale is increasing radon levels in people's homes. But environmental regulators don't agree with those findings. I'm Julie Grant. Next week, we continue to follow the pipeline with a closer look at whether fracking is making the radon problem worse. That's next week on the Allegheny Front.
It's baseball season, and everybody enjoys America's favorite pastime their own way. Pittsburgher Pete Schell waits outside of PNC Park on the banks of the Allegheny River. That's where he grabs fly balls beyond the outfield wall during the Pirates' pregame warm-ups. He's not a baseball player. He's a ball hawk, basically someone who chases down baseballs at major league parks. I'll let him explain.
Heading down, this is the river walk. Boats tie up here. You can see the river and all that kind of stuff. This is where I come down and shag home run balls. I grew up in Chicago, and so balls coming out of Wrigley Field, that's just in your blood. And so when I saw them designing the park and saw the layout, I said, okay, I'll be there. To me, it seemed natural. To most of the people that know me, they think I'm an absolute nut. For those fans that can't see, right behind us, what is that, 20 feet, is the Allegheny River. If you back up too much, you're going to fall into the river. Don't go back. I mean, every baseball player knows that, right? First step has to be back, or is it in? I never did very well with that. I think my favorite story, and I'm sorry for giving shout-outs, good friend of mine, Pastor Guy Wasco, he was a youth pastor here at our church on the north side. I stop in the office, the guy's like, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going down the river. For what? I said, well, come on. He's a Cubs fan. He understands. So he grabs a glove and comes down with me. Well, he talks to everybody. He's not focused on the ball because I guess pastors focus more on people than they do on baseballs. I'm a hawk. I'm looking for balls, and I see the one coming out. So I'm taking the first step. He doesn't see it. I'm racing after it. The ball bounces. As I'm reaching for the ball, and it's in my glove, I get smacked. The dude tackles me, knocks me down. I'm like rolling around, what just happened? And he's laughing and giggling and cackling, holding the ball. You looking for this? And I still can't believe it. To this day, can't believe that the youth pastor took me down for a baseball.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to PNC Park, the best ballpark in America. Tonight.
The question is, how many baseballs have I gotten? And I really don't have a clue whatsoever. Maybe 300, 400 baseballs, something like that. I give mine away. Just a few weeks ago, up in Brighton Heights, there was a team from Urban Impact Foundation, a wonderful inner city organization here in Pittsburgh that helps kids. And so I saw they were on the fields. I ran home, loaded up a bag full of Major League Baseballs, brought it out, gave it to one of the coaches. I said, look, I got to go. Make sure every boy gets one of these. And there's extra. Give them to the coaches, too. That's what I do with the balls. Just to see the thrill on their face, it's a Major League Baseball, it's worth it. I don't have a trophy room at home for baseballs. That's ridiculous. You'd have to be crazy to collect baseballs. I collect golf balls. I probably have about 1,500 logo golf balls at home. My wife thinks I have 50, so I hope she doesn't listen to this, but I don't collect the baseballs. The dream is to catch one on a fly, and obviously I age each year. I'm 50, almost 54, and I don't know how much longer I can chase balls down out here. I would love to catch one on a fly just to see, do I still have the reactions that I can see it, catch it? Because you only have about a second and a half. You know you're on when a bird flies and you've got two steps on it, right? Yeah, that's just, for me, it's fun. There's people set up chairs and stuff now, and look, they're barbecuing over there. That just gets in my way. But to me, that's not what the river walk's for. It's for catching baseballs during batting practice.
That was Pittsburgher and ball hawk Pete Schell. His story is part of a series of audio postcards about life on the Three Rivers by the Allegheny Front's Lou Bluen. To listen to more, go to alleghenyfront.org/ourthreerivers. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. Our series Follow the Pipeline is funded by the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. Heat of the Moment is funded by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve quality of life, promote community vitality, and achieve a fair society. The Joyce Foundation at joycefdn.org.